The story of God told through the land of Israel is written in the pages of Scripture and carved by the very finger of God into the land itself. Join us on a journey to discover your spiritual roots. Uncover the six essential elements of identity deep within you, revealed through the life of King David and perfected in the life of Jesus. The fourth season of Real Encounters with God, Downline. All new, on location in Israel. New places, new encounters, real encounters with God.
All right, this is Real Encounters with God. We are here in Israel talking about real people who had real encounters, hoping to have one as well. And in this season, we're talking about this primal DNA. You've called it the six essential elements of identity. Today is friend. Tell us about friend.
Well, this is, again, one of those things where David and Jesus, they're sharing the same literal DNA, but they also have the spiritual DNA seen in both their lives of a high value of friendships. And we actually have that in our life as well. That's the reason why we have so much suicides, and part of the reason why we have so much mental illness today. We are not well. And I think we're not well because we are lonelier than ever. We're out of sync with who we actually are. We're created to have friends, to be in community. And when you don't see that is who you are and you don't align yourself to that, there's going to be consequences. At least that's what's happening in America.
And so you'd say disconnection, lack of friendships is going up, friendships going down.
Yeah.
Yes, exactly. And therefore, mental illness is going up, and suicide is going up, and loneliness and all that stuff that comes with it. It's not by accident. It's not in the air. It's in the way we live our life, which is out of sync with our spiritual DNA.
Cyril,
is this America? Is this happening here in Israel?
Unfortunately, it also happens over here. Of course, we have the screens. We have many children, you know, all of us, big families in Israel. And you see how the way it affects people. And it's sad. Again, there is good, positive things on those screens, but there is definitely hard things. And many children today, you see that in the news, you see it in other places, they feel rejected, they feel people don't care for them, and there are no friendships, true friendships today.
I'm always surprised by this. It kind of makes sense in America.
Right.
Because we're founded on this rugged individualism and, you know, extreme capitalism, like make something of my life, which there's a lot of good things about that. That's kind of in American society's DNA, but here, it's more of that ancient communal culture. It's more in your culture's DNA.
It's true, and I thank God that it's not like in the States.
So it's not as bad.
No, not as bad, because as you said, the family, the structure, the Jewish communities, it's different living all together, and especially also there is the military service over here. And you have guys when they are 18 that they join together for 3 years. You know, it's really 3 years of friendship that you learn to trust your friends. You spend, you know, the hardest moments of your life are together with them. Also, the happiest ones are there. So you build friendship that lasts actually for the entire life. And Jesus, you know, he would experience the same thing, as you know that, with his disciples, with his group that were around him. And we were talking about David and trying to get there, you know, to where he would build his friendship. And you suggested the Cave of Adullam, right, in the past.
Yeah, I think that's good.
We were there, we were filming in the past. It's a beautiful place.
Love that place.
Yeah, and of course, there is a lot of friendships that were built there between David and his mighty man. So we would like to go and see that and try to put all those things together.
Now, you mentioned something that I got to say. I don't know if most people know, and I know, Brian, you're going to talk about this. Maybe you'll say it, but what is a mighty man? Like, what is that? You just said David and his mighty men. I don't have any mighty men in my context right now. So maybe I should if we're talking about friendship. What is that?
So with friendships, like attracts like. So if you're an artist, you're going to attract artists. If you're an athlete, you're going to attract athletes. That's probably most likely the kind of people you're going to have friends. David, man, he had all these six identities, but the one he was really known for initially was that warrior one, right? Going against Goliath. And so the young stud warriors were like, I want to be around David. So the mighty men came to be a few dozen people that had extreme ability in warfare and almost superhuman abilities to run and stuff like that. They're a crazy group known as the mighty men.
Right, so he's got his crew, basically. Yep. And we see that same thing in the life of Jesus. So we're going to Cave of Adullam for David, but where did you go to talk about Jesus and friendship? What's that about?
Okay, we thought about the upper room. You know, Jesus, in the last night before he was crucified, he gathered his team, you know. And over there, he does certain
things. Mighty men, basically, yeah. His mighty men.
This is his mighty men. As you said, these are the ones that are closest to him. We know that there were many that were following him, and not just with the thousands, but people that were following him the whole time, but there was the close circle of those 12. And Jesus is gathering them for that, what is known as the Passover Supper, the Last Supper. And over there, he built, and he wants them to understand that there is a true friendship. It's not only, I'm your master, I'm your rabbi. You know, it's not only that. There is much more than that. I give an example, of course, but you are my friends. I really see that way. And I see you in that way, and I expect you also to treat each other as friends one to the other. Okay, and then, of course, it goes more than that. But we thought that the upper room would be the right place to talk about Jesus' attitude and the friendship that he's building with his disciples.
Hannah and I head to the upper room with Suriel, where Jesus modeled true friendship to his disciples, while Brian makes his way to the Cave of Adullam, where David's mighty men showed what it looks like to be a real friend.
So, here we are, up on top of Mount Zion, standing on the place which is known as the upper room. And from up here, we can see behind us the Mount of Olives. This is where Jesus is coming from at the last week, Palm Sunday. He's walking through that mountain all the way down into the city of Jerusalem. We can also see where today the Golden Dome is. This is where the temple would stand. And he spent most of this week inside the temple area and around the temple, of course, and back and forth when he goes to Bethany to stay in his friend's house. Now, at the last night, we find Jesus being up here. Okay, we're here now on top of a building which is actually from the Crusaders period. So it's not what Jesus would actually experience as a room, but the location that, and the church was built here at the same location, it was destroyed. So the Crusaders, they come later on and they rebuild the place, but and they use some of the stones that were there. I can't say that this would be the room that Jesus would actually see.
But
the location is probably the right location. And we find that he spent time over there. They are eating what is known as a term, the Last Supper, which is actually the Passover meal that they eat just before the feast will start the next day. And after being here, then they go back down there to the Garden of Gethsemane. This is where Jesus is being arrested. From there, he's being taken back here to Mount Zion, to Caiaphas' house, the high priest. From here, he's being sent to Pontius Pilate, and eventually he is sent to where he was crucified.
What makes this meal so significant is that Jesus knows what's coming next. He's about to endure a hellish 18 hours, walking from the upper room to the Garden of Gethsemane, where he's arrested. Then, march through the night to the court of the high priest, where he's convicted in a joke of a trial. Then, taken to the local authorities to be beaten and humiliated, and ultimately crucified alongside criminals outside the city walls. Jesus was about to make the ultimate sacrifice, and still, he gives his attention to his friends. He serves them. He feeds them a meal. And in the face of awful events, Jesus is still an incredible friend.
So it's a very intensive and long night that Jesus is going through that really starts up here. We find five chapters in the Gospel of John that deal with what we call the Last Supper. It's many chapters for just meal, in a sense.
That's what a friend does. They know, he knew his time was coming to a close. He knew his time was coming to an end. And a friend looks at their friends like, okay, here's what you need to know, because there's some stuff's about to go down. Man, what would you say about how Jesus showed himself as a friend in the moments, maybe even in this location?
He was doing something none of them expected, right? He suddenly washes their feet.
Yeah.
I mean, imagine, you know, we don't really understand what they thought about Jesus during those 3 years, because they thought that he's a prophet, they thought that he's a rabbi, they thought that he's even sometimes they said the Son of God. What does it exactly means? I don't think they really understood. He wasn't dead yet, he wasn't risen dead, he wasn't ascended yet. What was it? They didn't receive yet the Holy Spirit even. So their understanding about Jesus was confusing, okay? But at the same time, they had a lot of respect towards him, okay? And over here, the last thing that they would expect of Jesus to do from Jesus is to wash their feet. Now, it was a common thing when they would enter somewhere, they would actually recline on the floor while they're eating on low beds. Not like today we sit in a table, right, with chairs and so on.
Right.
So their feet would be one beside the other, basically, when you're reclining, you know, in like a half round circle almost. So normally there would be someone that would wash their feet of the rest when they enter a house. I guess no one did it, or no one thought of that. But definitely Jesus was not the one that was supposed to do it in their mind. And he does that. And we find also Peter said, no way, you're never going to do that with me. In a sense, I will give you the full respect. You shouldn't do that. Jesus said, I'm not going to wash your feet. You have no part with me, right? So Peter said, give me the full bath. And Jesus said, there is no need of that too. Yeah.
He was one extreme or the other.
Yeah. Always, you know, Peter had to say something. But it's a true friendship. He teaches them in a way that he is an example. He never teaches them something, okay, you have to do something. And I'm just saying, he would do first, teach it, you know, the best teacher in a sense, and then tell them, now you've seen me, no excuses. You have to do the same thing, one to the other. So it's a true friend in a sense.
If you and I want to follow in the downline of David and Jesus, we have to unlock this primal DNA of friend, because that's what Jesus was. The people in this upper room were so much more than just his followers. They were his actual friends. You know, Jesus made friends everywhere he went. If you read between the lines of all of his teachings, you'll constantly see him going to people's houses, being invited to dinners. In fact, one of the biggest things kind of thrown in his face as an accusation was that he was a glutton and a drunkard, a friend of tax collectors and sinners. They'd be like saying, you there, you are somebody people want to be around, and you're always going to parties, and people always want to hang out with you. And you say yes to every invitation, every time. Yeah. Like, that's Jesus. People wanted to be around him. He was this amazing, amazing friend. And it was on this rooftop of the upper room where Jesus passed on the secret to incredible, powerful, God-centered friendships to his friends, which includes you and I. He said this in John chapter 15. Greater love has no one than this, that someone lay down his life for his friends. You are my friends if you do what I command you. No longer do I call you servants, for the servant does not know what his master is doing. But I have called you friends, for all that I've heard from my Father, I've made known to you. It's simple. If you want great friendships, you lay down your life for your friends. Now, for Jesus, the ultimate expression of that would happen in just a matter of hours from this moment when he goes to the cross. But that wasn't his first time laying down his life for his friends. He had done it again and again and again. This meal, I think Jesus paid for, the Last Supper. Why? Well, because we know his ministry was funded by donations given to him, and that offering paid for the entire traveling party. He had bought them many meals before this meal. See, if you want to follow in the downline of Jesus as friend, you want to begin to lay down your life to be that kind of Christ-centered friend, you can start by just buying somebody a meal. It turns out paying for someone's supper can be an incredibly powerful spiritual act. From the upper room, we trace the lineage of Jesus back 14 generations to where King David experienced true friendship in the cave of Adullam.
Good hike right there. This is the area where David would have been escaping his enemies. His enemies at this point are actually Saul and all of his forces who are trying to take him down. This region of Israel has always been sort of the border area. When I came up right back down there, you can see a paved road that's lined with barbed wire because that's the West Bank, very well known across our world. Conflict there all the time with tension. This is also the same place where there was a border with the Philistines, who were their arch enemies. Conflict is here. How do we get through conflict? What is the one of the ways that we endure so much of the difficulty in life? The answer is our friends. David has a son later on who he passes the kingship onto, and his son Solomon is known as the wisest person in the earth. And here's what Solomon says about friendships. Proverbs 18:24. A man of many companions may come to ruin, but there is a friend who sticks closer than a brother. We have a lot of people in our lives who we know, who are acquaintances, a lot of people we know who are maybe drinking buddies, a lot of people we know who are friends with us on social media, but very few of us have people who will stick closer to us than a brother or a sister. It's a massive, massive problem in our culture. In 1990, studies showed that 3% of Americans had no friends. In 2021, the stats were 12% of Americans had no friends. That's a 400% increase. Not good. For those of us who have 10 or more friends, in 1990, that was 33% of Americans had 10 or more friends. 2021, it's 13%. Down, down, down. We are not doing well. Our culture isn't organized and orchestrated to tap into this need we have inside of having deep, abiding friendships. It's actually a spiritual discipline, and you and I are created for it. It's in our primal DNA. Things that helped us in American culture long ago are pretty much gone. Softball leagues, gone. Bowling leagues, gone. I know there's some exceptions, but for the most part, gone. My parents and my mom used to be in bridge clubs. Those are gone. There were fraternal organizations like the Elks Club. They're gone. They don't exist anymore. And as these things have been stripped away from us, so have the common ground for building friendships been stripped away from us. Friends do things together. We hang together. We experience life together. Speaking of the Elks, some of my closest friends I go elk hunting with. Actually, we say it's not elk hunting, it's elk hiking, because we never see a freaking elk. We go on public land, we never see one, but yet we keep doing it year after year. That's because when we do, we're encountering life with each other. We're laughing with one another. We're sweating with one another. We're freezing with one another. We're camping with one another. We realize we're getting something out of the friendships that are going to be of unsurpassable value, even if we never actually get any elk-free meat inside of the freezer. This means that we've been very unhealthy as a culture. This is why mental illness, I believe, has gone way, way up. It's a loneliness epidemic that has awful, awful consequences. One study I saw shows that if you don't have any close friendships, the health consequences are equal to smoking 15 cigarettes a day. Another way to say that is if you got healthy relationships, maybe you can smoke 15 cigarettes a day and be in the clear. I don't know how far you want to take this, but this is a big, big deal. I'm a tobacco user in various forms. And I think it's a really good thing that our country has sounded the alarm bell saying, hey, danger here, be very careful, danger, danger, danger. I think we've done pretty well in that as a country. I think it's good news. I would just call on us to do the same thing as it relates to friendships. Hey, I'm ringing the bell right now. Danger, danger, danger. If you don't have close friendships, you are not going to be healthy. Mentally healthy, spiritually healthy, and physically healthy. This is a necessity. David has these kind of relationships. His closest friendship is with Jonathan. Here's how that is described. 1 Samuel 18:3. Then Jonathan made a covenant with David because he loved him as his own soul. Jonathan is the son of Saul, the current king, who should be next in line for the kingship, but Jonathan realizes that David's the guy. And they have this tight bond where Jonathan supports him and David supports Jonathan. It's actually referred to as covenantal. It's covenantal. I love that. Friendships are not transactional, they're covenantal. It's not I scratch your back, you scratch my back. It's not quid pro quo. It's I am committed to you even if you never do anything for me. Friends are great to help out with one another, right? Like, we help each other move. That's always a big deal, helping somebody move. But a great friend will only just help you move apartments. A great friend will help you move a body.
That's a covenantal friendship. But their friendship goes beyond helping each other. It's deep, it's wedded, it's in their DNA. Here's one of the ways it's described in the book of 2 Samuel. 2 Samuel 1:26 says, "I'm distressed for you, my brother Jonathan. Very pleasant have you been to me. Your love to me was extraordinary, surpassing the love of women." This verse has understandably caused many people to infer that David and Jonathan had a same-sex love affair, that perhaps Jonathan was gay and that David was bisexual because obviously he was with women as well. While I think this is understandable that we would come to this conclusion based on the wording in this verse, I think it's really indicting of our culture that we don't understand male friendship unless it's sexual in nature. We've become so lost to the narrative of personal pleasure, my personal sexual gratification, just being covered away, carried away by all that I feel, we can't see deep friendship when it's presented to us in the Bible. There's a kind of friendship a woman can have with a woman that she can't have with a man. There's a kind of friendship a man can have with a man that he can't have with a woman. I hear many people who are married say that my spouse, my best friend. I'm a little uncomfortable with that. Let me tell you why. First of all, in previous generations in America, if you kind of read the literature, people didn't refer to their spouse as best friend as we do often right now. I think what we're actually saying right now is my spouse is probably my only friend, the only friend I have. I also am uncomfortable referring to Lib and I as best friends because we're more than that. We're married. We're actually one flesh. That's a much deeper thing than actually being a friend. And there are things that I deal with and struggle with that she'll never understand. And in that way, my love of my male friends surpasses my love for her. Not that I love her more or them more than my wife, but it's a kind of life, a love, a kind of empathy, a kind of understanding that she won't be able to understand. I am, like many men, I am drawn to pornography. I am very visually stimulated. It is a fight to not do that. And I've done pornography more recently than I care to admit. And when I share that with my wife, she is understandably hurt, understandably confused. I get that. She should be. When I share that with my male friends, it's like, I get it. I got it. How can I help? What can we do together? They understand that thing. When I talk with a friend of mine who may be a pastor of a church that has a large staff, they can inherently understand my struggles in ways that Lib won't be able to understand. There's things that her friends will understand about her that I try to understand. I'm trying to get in her shoes, but I just will never get there as well as some of her other friends do. This is the beauty of David and Jonathan's friendship. They're both Jews. They're both warriors, hardcore warriors. They get each other. They go forward. They're in a covenantal relationship with one another where they're saying, no matter what happens around us, dude, I'm here for you. I'm here for you. I'm with you. I will die for you. I'll die by your side. These are the kind of friendships that you and I were wired for, the kind of friendships that we need and you actually were born to be able to have. It's actually in your DNA. I know there's not a person who's listening to this description who isn't saying, oh boy, that would be awesome. I would love that. I need to be that way. That's because your DNA is crying out to you saying, this is actually who you are. We just need to dust it off and put it into action. David doesn't just have a close friendship with Jonathan, but with a bunch of guys known as the Mighty Men who come to him in his time of need when he is fleeing Saul at the cave of Adullam, which is where we're on top of right now. Let's go there. So as David comes up in this area, he comes up to the cave of Adullam, and we're gonna go inside that cave right now. We're not sure if this is the exact opening, but it is certainly one of the openings in this region that everyone would have known this is where the cave is. There's a number of these openings right around this like quarter mile square radius or so. As David is escaping, he needs to amass an army. He needs to amass people who will help him. That's part of what friends do. They're your army. They're the people who actually help you. And there's about 400 guys
who come to be with him and they say, hey, he's up the Cave of Adullam, let's meet up there. Why would these 400 people come to him? Well, Bible says that they are distressed, in debt, and depressed. Why these folks? Well, these guys, many of them would have been farmers right here in the area. Again, this is a border area. The Philistine nation is right here, and perhaps they overtook some of their lands, and those ancient farmers would be like farmers today or business people today. You have to be capitalized. You need capital to buy your equipment, to cover your living expenses before the crops come in. And so perhaps they're capitalized, and then they lose their lands, and they can't make their debt payments. So they are not well. The people who are on David's side in his army are people who have issues. That's probably who we're going to have to be able to choose from in our own world when we have friends. People who aren't perfect. People who have rough spots. People have issues, because that's pretty much all of us. The only people who don't have issues are who we know as deluded. We all have our issues. We all have our challenges. Now, Jesus had people who he was in deep friendship with. They were known as his 12 disciples. And then the 12 disciples, he had an inner ring of three of them, Peter, James, and John, who he had the closest friendships with. I think David is operating in this realm as well. He's got 400 people who are around him, but he also has 37 of them, it tells us in 2 Samuel, who are his mighty men. These are the folks who identify with him, who understand his desire to be a warrior. And inside of this 37, there's a smaller ring as well. All of our friendships are going to have different rings to them. Not all of our friendships are going to be the same. Let's talk about that more. Actually, inside the cave where David bonded with his friends.
I love caves. Love, there's something about like the coolness of being removed, isolated, safe. I think maybe this is why David was drawn to the cave. He kind of felt secure, right? He was hemmed in. And he's here with all of his buddies. You know, like attracts like. Who you are the kind of people you're gonna attract. You like to read books? You're gonna attract people who like to read books. You like to build things? You're gonna attract people who build things. You like to play cards? You're gonna attract people who play cards. You like to ride motorcycles? You're gonna attract people who like to ride motorcycles. David attracted people who were warriors. There was this story, this understanding they all had that this is the guy when he was a little kid who killed a giant. So all the young studs that like fighting, they were attracted to David. This is the background for this story that's always fascinated me that happened here in this cave system. In the book of 2 Samuel chapter 23, verse 15, it says this, and David said longingly, oh, that someone would give me water to drink from the well of Bethlehem that is by the gate. Then the three mighty men broke through the camp of the Philistines and drew water out of the well of Bethlehem that was by the gate and carried and brought it to David. But he would not drink of it. He poured it out to the Lord. So David is in this cave. He's feeling secure. But at the same time, there's this whole outside world that's out there, and he can't have any part of it because if he goes out there, he's going to get killed. And he starts to think about all the things that he longed to have, all the things that made his life special. And he starts to think about how great the water out of this specific well is. Like, oh, he's just kind of talking with his buddies, and he just goes like, oh, that well. Oh, it's the best water. What I wouldn't give to have that right now. He processes that with them. And his buddies hear this. And they circle up like, hey, what, you up for adventure? Yeah, I'm up. Hajit, you up for adventure? Yeah. How about this? How about we go and we get him that water? And someone says, dude, there's like enemies out there. That's occupied territory. Like, we could get found and killed. And someone else goes, I know. That's why it sounds fun. Like, again, like attracts like. The kind of guy, as a boy, who would say, I want to fight a giant, attracts the kind of guys who say,
let's go on a mission where we might lose our lives. And so they sneak through enemy territory, they get to the well, and they carry water back. We talk about water carriers, people who do very hard, difficult things. That's what they do. They carry water. I mean, it's heavy. It's awkward. They bring it back. They sneak through, and they come to David, and they go, here you go. Here you go. Your wish is our command. David had wished this. He actually hadn't said anything to them, though. And it strikes him. It dawns on him what his friends have done, the sacrifice that they've put themselves into, how they've risked life and limb. And he gets this water, and he's thinking about how, and he goes like this. He goes, guys, this is an amazing sacrifice, and I'm not worthy of this sacrifice. This kind of sacrifice, the only person who's worthy of it is God. And he pours this water out. And he says, this is God. This is God's. I'm going to give him this offering. And I can imagine the mighty men, at first, they're thinking, whoa, we put our life at risk for you and you're not even going to taste it? I think they thought that at first. And then they go, that's why you're my guy. Right there, right there. David says, I'm not worthy of this kind of sacrifice. I'm not, but God's worthy of it. And these guys realize that's why we're drawn to you. It's not just the thrill of adventure and the risk of life and limb. You've got a heart for God and you're going God's way. And we just saw it and that's what we're about to. And they have that. Gosh, dudes, ladies, men, I'll tell you what. When you find friends that you have things in common with, and the most important thing is a heart for God and the ways of God. Oh my goodness, you are on to something really, really big. This is what David had. Fortunately, this is what I have too. We generally use fires for ambiance, but back in David's day, it was about sustenance, staying warm, actually cooking yourself some meat. I've got some really, really great friends. And like attracts like, we ride bikes together, we do all kinds of things together. But man, I'll tell you what, you never know when you're gonna actually need your friends. So several years ago, I got a call that nobody wants to ever have when I learned that my wife, Olivia, just had a stroke. I've known people who've had strokes before. It doesn't end well just about all the time. It could be ending in a wheelchair, walker, bedridden, whatever it is. And I'm thinking our life is probably permanently changed now. I rush to the emergency room. I look at my wife. Lib can't, she can't move. She can move her eyes around. That's it. They're gonna take her into surgery, try to pull the blood clot out of her brain. I put out an APB to all my friends. Hey, would you please pray? They said, what can you do? I'm like, nothing, just pray. There's nothing you can do. You're not doctors, you're not here. Well, they weren't gonna take no for an answer. They need to figure out some way to actually be engaged. Sometimes later, I get a text saying, hey, we're here for you. We're out in the parking lot. We're praying for you. And if you could break away, we've got some beers here for you too. When I could get away, when it was safe to do so, I went to the parking lot and there were my buddies. They were just hanging there and we opened my truck tailgate and they pulled out a cooler and we had a couple beers. I don't know if you're allowed to have beer in a public hospital in the parking lot. I don't know. And you know what else? I don't really care. And my friends didn't care either. All they cared was, I got a friend who's hurting. We need to give him some relief. And we sat there and had a couple of the best beers I've ever had. It wasn't the beer I needed. I wasn't trying to medicate myself. They weren't trying to medicate me. I didn't get a buzz or anything. But I did get a buzz on the empathy that they showed me. It's like our brain chemistry was linking together. And they were telling me, we got you, man. We want to cover you. We care for you. We love you. We're with you. That's the power of friendship. It's primal inside of us. It's part of our DNA. That's why Jesus says, I no longer call you servants, but friends, because a servant doesn't know his master's business. All I've known from the Father, I've made known to you. Jesus calls himself our friend. What does a friend do? A friend lays down his life. A friend puts himself on the line. That's what Jesus did for us. That's what David's friends did for David. Getting that water, laying their life down. Jesus lays his life down for us. Now, we've got to be really careful, because right around now, some of us could start to get bitter. We could start to go like, I don't have friends like this. I don't have anybody bringing me water. I don't have anybody bringing me a beer. I'm at the hospital in crisis. No one's coming and seeing me. Where are they? Before we have a pity party for ourselves, and before we start being critical of people who aren't doing what we think that they should be doing, let's remember here, friendship is not transactional, it's covenantal. It's not, I do this for you and you do this for me. It is, I'm laying down my life. No matter what you do, that's a covenant. So before we get upset with somebody else, we have to ask ourselves the question, am I being the kind of friend I want to have? Like attracts like. If you're laying down your life, serving others, you have a chance of having somebody else do that for you. I like meat. I do. I'm a meat eater, and I'm also a meat harvester. When I kill wild game, whether it be elk or deer, whatever it is, I like to process it, and then I like to take it to places like man camp, and I like to give it to people. People I want to serve. People who might actually be my current friend, or maybe people who might be my future friend. I'm trying to build into others. That's what a friend does. What are you doing to build into people who are around you? How are you telling people they are of value, they are of worth, and you are worth laying down your life for them? If you choose to be the kind of friend that you want and you choose to enter into covenantal understanding with people, get ready. Your life is going to go deep. Jesus had a deep life because he was a friend. David had a deep life because he was a friend. You can have a deep life as well, but not until you become the friend that you actually want to have. Let me pray for you right now. God, I pray that you would bless the friendships or the potential friendships that are with us right now. I pray that you'd help us to remember what you taught us and help us to be the friend that you have enabled us to be. Lord, we just want to be like you. We want to have unlocked inside of us who you've already created us to be. And I pray these things according to the name of Jesus. Amen. Go be a great friend.
Next week on Real Encounters with God, we uncover David as ruler and how God gives all of us a domain that we are king or queen of, where we need to bring order to chaos. The six essential identities God has woven into our primal DNA are the key to having a life that works. Don't miss out on discovering your spiritual roots and unlocking the God-given identity of a ruler within you.